Good evening and welcome to Catch the Flavor Youth Radio on Radio Regent. I'm your host, Judy, and tonight we are celebrating International Women's Day with special guest speaker Tasia Chico-Green, currently the director and founder of Solidarity Conscious. Tasia graduated from York University with a master's degree in environmental studies, and she's worked at the University of Toronto and Western University and has lived personal and work experience moving women's rights forward. So welcome, Tasia, to our show. Great. So we just had some questions. We wanted you to help us educate our audience about why it's important to celebrate International Women's Day. So can you tell us what your experience in social justice work has taught you about the landscape of gender equity today?
International Women's Day is just an amazing opportunity to realize that women are not alone wherever we are, whether you're in a big city or a rural area, whether you're in Canada or in the Caribbean, whether you're in Southeast Asia or in South America, we all celebrate International Women's Day. And it's in Toronto, it's really hard to know that unless you're directly involved in activism, in women's activism, in the anti-violence against women movement, in projects and organizations that are working on gender-based violence. Unless you're directly engaged in those things, you don't necessarily realize just how incredibly big and international this celebration is. So my most important exposure to International Women's Day was in my early 20s in Toronto. At that time, I was a volunteer at CKLN Community Radio. It was my first experience as a radio host, and I've worked in the media, and I've been a journalist ever since, a little bit on and off in the 90s, but especially through the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And just as you are doing today with your program, just as you and your colleagues and your peers are doing through Regent Park Focus and all kinds of different community radio shows, the media is one of the best ways to get involved in International Women's Day and to get involved, frankly, in the movements, the many different movements, not just for women's human rights, but for social justice. And by social justice, I mean the transformation. So let me just paint a picture for you. You're on the radio now. You've got people listening to the radio now. They may be in their houses, in their homes. But back in the early 90s, there were some real, very forward and courageous women at the leadership of CKLN Radio, which used to broadcast on the FM dial at 88.1 out of Ryerson University. Back then it was Ryerson Polytechnic. And you had folks like Poonam Khosla and colleagues like Andrea Ritchie, other folks like Naomi Binderwall. And these were leading activists at the time. There are so many others that I'm not naming just now. But Poonam Khosla, as an example, was a forerunner in community radio, and she continues to do her activism and her scholarship as a South Asian lesbian. And she thought, let's figure out how to bring International Women's Day live and direct to the people. And so they figure out with the relatively basic technology that they had at the time, how to go to Convocation Hall, which is the biggest auditorium at University of Toronto campus, over there near St. George Street. And they brought their outfit there, and they managed to work out all the technology and have a live broadcast from the big rally, which was the start of the International Women's Day Parade. And as community radio broadcasters, what they would do was they would set up a booth, and as women would come into the room to develop the big sense of unanimity at the rally before the parade would begin, she would interview people. They would bring in guest hosts from different anti-violence organizations. They would bring in women who are the leadership of organizing within their trade unions, within their workplaces, within their neighborhoods and community and health centers. And they would interview them about what's the pressing issue of the day for those women. And of course, then as of now, the same issues would come forward. It would be, you know, I'm experiencing violence within my house. You know, my father is oppressing me as a young woman, as a teenager, and saying, who I should date or not date at all and what I should do with my body. There would be stories about women who were immigrant women who were being kept in a double bind between a husband that was stressed out and abusing them and not wanting to go to the authorities because the authorities might just deport them all. There were stories of girls who were being neglected when they would go to school because the teachers were being sexist, or if they were young girls of color, the teachers didn't take them seriously, that they were smart or that they could even speak English. And you'd hear these stories, and you'd hear not just about the pains and the hardships and the barriers and the pressure, but you'd also hear about what were those girls doing about it? How were they standing up for themselves? How would they come home and inform their mothers and the rest of their family, you know, this is happening to me, I need support. You'd hear about women mobilizing in the case of a man who was being abusive and threatening towards his wife or his girlfriend, mobilizing to take her to safety and to keep her away from him and to make sure her children were sheltered. You'd hear about stories about women who were domestic workers, especially in the Caribbean, the Filipino communities, who were facing violence and sexual harassment, sometimes sexual violence, at the hands of the people who were employing them and forcing them to be live-in caregivers under such brutal conditions. Organizations such as Intercede. All these years later, from the early 1990s until now, these organizations are still working and working really hard in Toronto. But what was beautiful about me as that, as my primary point of entry to International Women's Day and to the women's movement, was the very important experience of dialogue, just sitting down and having conversations with each other. As women of all ages, as women from more and more, our conversations centered around and brought forward the very marginalized voices of racialized women from South Asia and from Africa and from all over the place, where radio stations and publications such as CBC and the Globe and Mail would never think to talk to us like we were taking care of ourselves. Our radio station, TKLN, would put those women at the front and ask them, who are you, what's your experience, and what do you do? And what's really interesting is that so many of those women who came also from the Middle East, from Palestine, they would come and they'd say, you know, back home, we celebrated International Women's Day in these ways. And so you got a real sense not only of women's power, of women's courage, of us standing up for ourselves and our sisters across generations and across differences, but you also got a sense of the fact that this is something that is global. And at the very simultaneous moment of March 8th, women are actually demonstrating, they're protesting, they're doing teach-ins, they are going to legislatures in every nation of the world on that very same day.
Mm-hmm. So how was that first experience as a radio host for you? It seems like it almost feels like a full circle moment for you. You start off hosting for International Women's Day, and today you're a guest for International Women's Day.
Sorry, Judy, can you repeat the question? It's just a little hard hearing.
So we're wondering, how was that first experience for you? I mean, that seems pretty heavy as a first show for a radio host.
Well, you know, I was an assistant radio host because we actually, you know, all the women involved, there must have been a roster of a good two or three dozen women all told involved in volunteering that day. And in the lead up, they spent weeks putting together 24 hours back-to-back programming, all women on the air. And we called it Radio Feminist International, RFI. To put together, as you know, to put together that much program, you've got to have a lot of advanced preparation. And so when we would come together at that rally, it felt like pressure, but it was more exciting than anything else. And you weren't alone. You had two or three hosts on deck at the same time, and then you'd take breaks and switch out. Somebody would roam around with a microphone and get little snippets of conversations that people were having, or hear some chanting or some singing and record it and bring it back and play it. You had artists at Women's Day, International Women's Day. You had performers who were doing their comedy routines. You absolutely had musicians. You had the Japanese taiko drummers who were some incredible Japanese queer folks coming out, queer and lesbian women coming out. You had indigenous women from different areas of southern Ontario, many of whom had come, some of them had come from all across the country and were residing in Toronto and bringing forward their particular songs and their particular drumming styles and traditions, but with always a spirit of excitement and possibility and power in the fact that we would join and gather together. We were, in that day, in that moment, we were no longer alone and isolated, and so all of our fears would really fall away. Mm-hmm. So that kind of a hosting environment, frankly, was very, very empowering. And I hear a lot of women talking now, because we have social media, we have so many channels online, we have YouTube, people put things, little snippets on Instagram and through Twitter, people upload different kinds of recordings on Facebook, and a lot of us are all talking with each other. But radio is unique in the sense that it's live.
Mm-hmm.
Also in the sense that it can bring people together simultaneously and not out of sync, like online sometimes tends to do. The other thing that was really, I think, very, very important at that time, and it continues to be, and it has had its own ebb and flow over the years, is that women who do not identify as straight, women who are actually on the gender spectrum, women who are on the sexuality spectrum, women who are trans to a lesser extent, but yes, very much trans women got their first opportunities in Toronto, like lesbian women did, to even speak to the public, to be able to even voice their opinions through community radio. Indigenous women who are Two-Spirit coming on and speaking about their own experiences. It really was, I think, the late 1980s and into the early 90s, it was kind of a transition moment. And we saw also there was a contest. There was a sort of a history, a very fractured kind of history of the International Women's Day march and rally and all the organizing being done by white women in society, some of whom had been very, very staunch activists in the right to access free, health-covered, free and safe abortions, had come to the forefront, many of them coming up through the health clinic sector and some through the labor movement sector and some in both instances to lead the International Women's Day March. But they didn't understand, they didn't comprehend, and they didn't, frankly, make a lot of effort in the early days to reach out to racialized women, to indigenous women, and to figure out how could there be a common cause and a common coordination so that there'd be a common spotlight on all of our various issues. And there was a bit of a fight back then, and in the end, the fight and the contest and the challenge resulted in an organization called Women Working for Immigrant Women taking the helm of the coordination of International Women's Day. And to this day, they've been involved, the labor movement has been involved, individuals from health access and health rights and reproductive rights sectors have been involved. And so all of those sectors remain very, very important. But the question now in 2017 is, who should be leading? Who are the agitators? Who are the women who are putting their bodies on the line for other women, with other women? Who are the women? Who are the women across gender spectrum and across sexual spectrum, across racial spectrums? Who are the ones at the forefront who are saying, what we've done over the last couple of decades achieved a lot, but we're actually now needing to step up. We're needing to press forward another level. We need another type of radical feminist organizing that's really going to press back against some of the complacency that has come in. Because, Judy, you may not have had the opportunity to study the history, but we're going through a time where we're realizing the inequity and the inequality is much, much higher than it's been.
Mm-hmm.
Since our parents' lifetimes and even their parents' lifetimes. We're looking at the violences that are brewing, and it's not just looking south of the border. It's happening here. It's not just happening in Quebec, like at the shooting at the mosque. It's happening in our neighborhoods. It's happening on the subways. It's happening on the trains. It's happening in our classrooms. In higher education, I know there's been a ton of organizing happening at some of the universities like Ryerson University and Western University, where you've got organizations of young students of color, most of whom, frankly, are racialized women, really pushing and agitating for an education system that doesn't hate us, mm-hmm. that doesn't teach us to hate ourselves and each other, that doesn't teach us just to accept and to turn ourselves into mini entrepreneurs and mini businesses, but an education system that actually acknowledges the global wealth of knowledge and the long, long history of knowledge and intellect and even traditions and philosophies that indigenous peoples have here on Turtle Island in matrilineal, you know, women-loving and women-leading societies in North America, in the Americas, in Africa, all across the globe. And it's young women who are really pressing, young women of color, young indigenous women who are really pressing at this moment now for a much, much more radical rethink of, we've got to pull folks out of poverty. We've got to get rid of this incredible marginalization of girls and women on reserve and off reserve. We've got to valorize the lives of indigenous women and girls. We've got to valorize the lives of Muslim women, wherever they may come from or be born. We've got to valorize black women's lives who are being disproportionately surveilled and targeted and policed and expelled. All of these issues, they're no longer going to be answered by just trying to appeal to the government to fund grants for anti-violence services, to fund grants for arts, to fund grants for, you know, small student loans or small private loans or small business loans. None of that stuff is really going to resolve what we need. And so I think my message today, my message in the context of International Women's Day, is to look sideways and find who is the most vulnerable among us. If I have a degree of privilege, how might I work in solidarity? How might I recognize my sisters? How might I go about educating myself more about women and girls who may be like me or may be completely different from me?
So you mentioned how dialogue has really helped open up space for diverse women. How do you think that has changed the landscape from then to now?
How has dialogue changed?
Oh, no. How has the dialogue, opening up dialogue, helped move women forward?
I think in every instance, dialogue has to have at least three key elements.
Okay.
So the first thing in dialogue is that it literally has to be face-to-face. You need people where they live, where they work, where they are, to actually come together and look each other in the eye and say, I'm listening, I will listen to you, and then I would like to speak. And in order for that kind of an event to take place, you have to make sure that everyone can come to the table to speak. There was a recent quote, I think it was Desmond Cole, repeated it at an event at University of Toronto Scarborough. They had a big TEDx talk a couple months back. And he said, you know, if you're not at the table, if you're not invited as a formal person to sit at the table where there's a meeting and a conversation taking place, most likely you're on the table. You're being served up. Mm-hmm. You're being carved up like your dinner, right? And if you're on the table, people are talking about your issues, but they don't know your issues, and they're speaking for you in a paternalistic kind of way. If you're on the table, it's quite likely you're being carved up and your experiences, your traditions, your culture, your needs are being eaten. They're literally being taken for somebody else to go and take them forward and use them to advance their own agenda and maybe even their own status or their own career. So for dialogue to take place, you need women literally at the table, facing each other as women, facing the men who are there, maybe they are currently the decision makers, facing each other so that the details can be heard, the experiences mm-hmm. can be heard, women's analysis can be heard and heard well and received thoroughly. And with dialogue, it takes time. You can't just tweet something out or send a report that's text-based and written and say, read this, understand this. With dialogue, you're actually listening to people from their own mouths with their bodies sitting in front of you. It is an energetic experience. And when you have somebody sitting there within their own body, it becomes much, much more difficult to deny their humanity. And so that's what dialogue has created. There have been times over this period that we're sort of discussing, the last 30 years or even the last 5 years, there have been times when women have, through their own activism and organizing and pressure, been brought to the table or made their way or forced their way to the table to have that dialogue with authorities. It's rare that that stuff actually happens. It's usually through the official channels. Somebody gets elected, then they get into a formal position, and they get to be there. But lately, what we have seen more and more, we've seen Indigenous women rise up with the Idle No More movement, and to create through, for the first time, frankly, in Canada, to create through social media a new style of activism that has really taken off globally. They put the word out. They pressed the agenda. They connected with each other. And they created this conversation over social media that was just online, a reflection of what was happening in localities. So those meetings, those dialogues were happening in different smaller communities, among families, between neighbors. And then they would go and they would connect with each other further online. And that gave a model that has since been taken off in many directions, and most recently and most perhaps most successfully taken forward through Black Lives Matter as another movement that was begun by queer women of color, queer black women specifically in the U.S., and queer and trans women in Toronto for the BLMTO movement. And Black Lives Matter, as we know, because people of African descent have been trafficked and forced to live in all corners of the world, our diasporas, we all experience the same kinds of phenomena wherever we may be. And so Black Lives Matter, as led and mobilized and pushed forward by women, really does exist internationally.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about the future of feminism now that, in light of the current presidential election?
Well, I must say, even though I personally couldn't attend the International Women's March that happened the day after the inauguration of the U.S. president, because I was sick that day, I decided to follow it on social media, looking at the posts on Twitter, and I was listening and watching the live broadcast that Democracy Now! Had been streaming online. And I listened to woman after woman get up and speak at the actual Washington event. And I was both elated and heartened and not surprised at all for these reasons, which is I've been an activist within the labor movement, within labor unions. I've been an activist and organizer around critical media that covers all kinds of equality issues. I have been an activist organizing around anti-racism within marginalized communities such as the LGBTQ community, which is still very much dominated by white and middle class, sometimes even elite, white gay men and women. I have been an activist on different fronts in terms of educating young people and making sure that they get a say and a much more collaborative role. I've been an activist in quarters where mass mobilization seems, you know, the thing that belongs to that particular movement. And I keep in mind here the labor movement. You know, I've been out at protests against so many different kinds of wars and aggressive military actions. And it was not surprising at all for me that on the day after the inauguration, it was women of color who had organized, who had conceptualized, who had mobilized the resources and managed to reach the millions and millions of people around the world to come out and successfully protest. And so it was incredibly heartening to me. It's something that I've been trying to write about. It's something that I've been trying to speak about wherever I go, because it's such an incredible achievement. Our women's movements suffered a really incredibly serious blow through the end of the late 90s, through the 2000s. In Canada, it was kind of dissipated and decimated. And part of the reason was that people had fought for funding for anti-gender-based violence services, and the funding, to some extent, was achieved. They'd fought for funding for women who had been victimized by sexual assault and other kinds of sexual and domestic violence, and to some extent, those funds were created. And so when that stuff is achieved by a small group of women who are already relatively enfranchised at the leadership, they kind of step aside and say, well, it's done now, we're equal. And there has been a big, big enfranchisement, relatively speaking, of white middle-class women into relatively good jobs across different sectors of the labor force. Mm-hmm. And so as those white women have achieved those jobs, they have given many people in Canada the notion, the incorrect notion, that there is gender equality. And where those women have decent jobs and they've got a decent salary and they've been able to afford to buy homes and buy cars and raise their children and send their children to college and university, they have stopped fighting. Mm-hmm. In fact, many people have analyzed that the election of the president that is currently sitting in Washington was done because white women betrayed women of color, because those very white women I just named felt enfranchised enough that they didn't have to take any kind of radical position, that they could go right ahead and vote for this fella who's there now in a direct protest vote against those who are without status, those who are criminalized, and those who are poor, because they want to protect their own achievements into some kind of secure middle class. Mm-hmm. So that split was very, very vitally playing out all across places like Ontario, places like BC and Quebec. And it kind of represents an unfortunately limited and nearsighted type of feminism, a very I've got mine kind of feminism. And it's a feminism of old. It's the feminism of the early 20th century, the 19th century. You know, it's a feminism of white women that allowed slavery to persist in Canada and the U.S., but thought, okay, I'm going to get my own vote. It's a feminism that has allowed, you know, this foreign domestic worker and foreign migrant farm worker program, where we've got women of color coming from places like Indonesia or the Philippines or different areas of East Africa, different areas of Central and South America, coming to be domestic and foreign domestic workers and farm workers under vastly precarious conditions. We've got those very white women growing old, going into nursing homes, and all of their needs and caretaking being done by incredibly insecure, incredibly low-wage women of color who are feeding them and cleaning them and taking care of their linens. You know, this kind of absolute disparity among women persists because those white women got their little bit and then started turning around and saying there is equality here.
So maybe it is.
So the point is, who are we talking about when we're talking about feminists today? And I know a lot of women of color and Indigenous women have had a real hesitation to adopt this word feminist because they see those white women as representing the concept of what is feminism. But I will end my conversation with you drawing back to where I began our conversation, which is that all you need to do is do a little bit of research to look sideways, and you see how vital feminism and International Women's Day is for women in the poorest of communities in the global South. All across the world, this is a moment to rejoice and come together. There's a real value in claiming feminism. There's a real value of the most marginalized among us claiming that space and saying, actually, the feminism that we practice is what is going to transform the world and bring real equity and bring real social justice.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the insightful, informative, and provocative interview. So we're sure you're able to help educate our audience. And thank you so much for this. You're very, very knowledgeable. So we really appreciate your time.
You're so welcome, Judy. I appreciate you reaching out. And I want to wish you and your crew and all the listeners a very happy and very powerful International Women's Day.
Well, thank you so much. That's
all
we
have.
All right. Take care.